Welcome, everybody, to a Baseball America podcast. Along with JJ Cooper, I'm John Manuel. Thanks for the download. I want to remind you that Baseball America now has a mobile version. It's been out for a few months. It's mobile Baseball America. You can check out the mobile Baseball America on your mobile device. Type in baseballamerica.com on your mobile browser and get the latest Baseball America news. You also could have your digital edition. We've got a lot of different ways to digest Baseball America as 2011 ends and turns to 2012. Just in time for our Mayan disaster, there are millions of ways that you can digest Baseball America and our content, JJ, and the podcast is one of them, of course.
And one of the things, speaking of content, we're very happy here.
It's, oh, yeah, speaking of content.
It's December 22nd, and we can say happily that the Prospect Handbook has been sent to the printer.
Now, it's the reason that we haven't had a podcast in a couple of weeks. And
we've been kind of hunkered down.
Yeah, and it's the reason that Jim Callis's Twitter has been quiet for the most part. But I think the last time we had a podcast was right after the Rule 5 draft with you and Matt Eddy. So we're going to give you one last podcast for 2011. And before we flip it into 2012, I think our next podcast actually will probably be from Anaheim with Nathan Rohde and Aaron Fitt wrapping up the college baseball news from the American Baseball Coaches Association convention. And then we'll come back with your American League East podcast and wrap those up. But, JJ, we're going to talk National League West top 10s. Obviously, all the top 30s are done for the handbook, but we're going to stick to the top 10s. You know, wait till the handbook comes out to do a big handbook podcast. But the National League West has been active since the winter meetings with a couple of big trades. The last trade that made it into the handbook, the last transaction in the handbook, which was the Diamondbacks trade, trading Jared Parker.
Right.
To
we will
the,
give you on
the,
here. We will give you an update to let you know what the top 10 is post trade.
Right. And then we had obviously the Padres. So a lot of has gone on with the National League West.
Matt
That's Lalo's timely.
Trade to the Reds.
We'll also talk some Yu Darvish, by the way, on this podcast. But let's start off with the Diamondbacks, JJ, because when the issue went to press, you had Jared Parker at number 4. And Jared Parker, I think, is an interesting way to start talking about the Diamondback system because he'd been number one in the system for several years, including one year where he was number one even though he didn't pitch, basically, with Tommy John surgery. So he'd been number one since 2009, 2010, 2011. Now for this one, he had moved down to number 4. I think it just tells you just how much better their system has gotten over the last couple of years. This is a team and a franchise that won at the major league level and got better in the farm system at the same time, which is difficult to do.
Why do you think DePoto has a new job now?
That's right.
That's
one of the reasons.
Is that because he really did a good job in his time as an interim GM. But Jared Parker is, you could make an argument, is a better prospect right now than he was a year ago.
That's possible. You could definitely argue
because
that.
Because a year ago, he was essentially coming off of TJ, and
right.
the unknown was there.
Correct. A lot more unknown than there is now.
Whereas now, he had a solid year. It wasn't a spectacular, but it was a very solid year. So showed that his stuff is largely back.
Right.
So you could make that argument that he's a little better right now than he was at, you know, at this time last year when it was like, well, he had a good instructs. Which,
right.
Again,
right.
as we've always said, you don't hear a whole lot of guys having a bad instructs.
That's almost akin to showing up at spring training in the best shape of your life.
Right.
You know, the good instructs is the organization version of that. Yeah, he had a bad year, but he had a good instructs.
You know, but you look at him and he was number 4 because they brought in a lot of they've acquired through trade, through draft, through different ways. They have a lot of interesting pitching now.
Yeah, I think that Tyler Skaggs would have been a number 1 prospect in the majority of organizations. I don't know if I will say at least 16 without going through them all. To me, Tyler Skaggs is better than most teams' top prospects. I mean, he's better than like some good farm system's top prospects. I mean, the Reds are a good farm system. Tyler Skaggs versus Devin Mesoraco, that's going to be a push.
Close.
That's very close. You know, there's some I think there's some organizations that would rather have Mesoraco because of the position scarcity, and there are others that would have Skaggs, a left-hander who
position
was third
scarcity.
In the, what was he, fourth in the minor league in strikeouts? I mean, most years you lead the minor leagues with 198 strikeouts. We just happen to have three guys with 200 strikeouts in the minor leagues this year, and he's number 3. You know, Archie Bradley, in a lot of years, Archie Bradley's the top high school right-handed pitcher in the draft class. Yeah, this year he wasn't even
and
the best one in the state.
From everything we've heard, he did have a great instruction.
And we have heard massive buzz on his instructional league that he was dominant. Trevor Bauer, in most years, he's the top college pitcher drafted. This year he was the 3rd. You know, he's our college player of the year. So they had a great draft with Bauer and Bradley. they had a tremendous year in a trade acquisition like Tyler Skaggs. So that's why a guy like Jared Parker comes back from Tommy John surgery and falls. And I think, J.J., they leveraged him in a trade for a pitcher who's only 8 months older and got an established big leaguer in Trevor Cahill.
I love that trade for the Diamondbacks because
I do too.
If realistically what you're hoping, if you're the A's, the hope with Parker is that Parker gives you what Cahill was giving you, but does it for the next 6 years.
I think Parker will actually probably have a more consistent year than Trevor Cahill just because he's more of a strikeout guy, less of a ground ball guy. I do think that Cahill will miss some of the defense that was behind him in Oakland. I think, you know, I like Cliff Pennington as a shortstop. Defensively, I'd take Pennington over Stephen Drew. I'd probably take Jamile Weeks over Aaron Hill. We'll see. The infield for Arizona with Drew and Hill and Paul Goldschmidt, Ryan Roberts, there's not a Gold Glover there. So we'll see how that plays. But I still think that Trevor Cahill is not just going to be just a ground ball guy his whole career. He's athletic. He's young. He's got a big arm. And I really like Trevor Cahill.
And let's be honest, the other two pieces that the Diamondbacks gave up are
fungible.
They're nice secondary pieces. But I'll put it this way, if Colin Cowgill gets 500 at bats this year for the A's, nothing is Colin Cowgill, but that's probably not a good sign for the A's.
Colin Cowgill's upside, his best case scenario is a Cody Ross career. And he gets compared to Ross a lot because of their size and because they're both bats right, throws left guys. But I think that's a good comp. And I don't think he's as toolsy as Cody Ross. He has a chance to be a more consistent hitter, but he's not as toolsy as Cody Ross, and he's not as much of a center fielder. In his career, Ross has played a lot of center. So, Cowgill's kind of a poor man's Cody Ross. I mean, he wasn't in the Diamondbacks' top 10. He's easily in the top 10 for the Athletics, which obviously hasn't come out yet. We'll have it out. They're one of the last ones, and Jim Schoenert will chat about them probably at the end of January. Colin Cowgill's safely in their top 10. And Ryan Cook's kind of an extra arm. He instantly becomes one of the better arms in the Athletics farm system. So I like that trade. I think the Diamondbacks, J.J., are clearly the best farm system in the National League West.
No, I think – and the interesting thing about that is there's not a whole lot of position player talent right now, in that system. But that's okay because –
once you graduate a Goldschmidt, there's a guy with that kind of power. There really isn't a lot of
– but
big league ready, especially, I would say. A.J. Pollock is polished – and can help them in the major leagues in 2012 in the second half if need be. But that's really about it for big league ready.
But, I mean, we just talked about three pitchers who are still in the system. We talked about a fourth who's not. And we could still talk about pitching after that is the thing jumps out.
Like, I like David Holmberg.
David Holmberg is a very interesting guy. Pat Corbin is an interesting guy. There are other guys in that organization that you say, okay, that guy has a chance to do something.
Yeah, the intriguing guy for me, I think we probably should be done with the Diamondbacks soon, is the intriguing guy for me is Chris Owings in their system. Big strikeout-to-walk issues, big pitch recognition issues, it looks like, at this stage. But he's a young, toolsy, middle-of-the-diamond player. I'll be fascinated to watch his progress. I like Chris Owings. I liked him out of high school. He's a big key for me because he's really like the middle of the diamond prospect who stands out in the Diamondbacks organization with upside, and they don't have a whole lot of other guys like that. The other big, I guess, farm system that we should talk about, the next best farm system in the division, and the other team that was heavily involved in the trade, J.J., was the Padres. The Padres, and we talked about this on the Baseball America show last Sunday on Sirius XM, the Padres make this trade where they trade Matt Latos for Yonder Alonso, Yasmani Grandal, Brad Boxberger and Edinson Volquez. Pretty intriguing trade. You are a Reds guy. Where would you slot those prospects in the Padres system?
Let me say, like, post that trade, now if you're talking what's the top farm system in the division, it's a much closer battle.
It is much closer. I still like the Diamondbacks better, but I think it's a lot closer after that trade because Yonder Alonso is a big league ready. He could be a star. He could be a star. I think
it's more likely to be a above-average offensive first baseman. And by that, I mean, like, I don't know if he'll be a star because star at first base, the bar to be a star at first base is pretty high.
It is high. I agree.
He will be a better hitter.
That was a good Soucian sentence, too, the bar to be a star.
But he will be a better hitter. Draw more, good on base, good at batting average, I think, than most NL first baseman. I think.
Yeah, I think we were ranking our prospects in the handbook, and we were lining them up by position. He's the best minor league. He's the best first baseman who's eligible in the book. It was basically him, Anthony Rizzo, who was already a Padre, and Jonathan Singleton were the top three guys. And I think our office consensus would be Alonso. I think the industry consensus would be Alonso. There are some similarities between Yonder Alonso and Adrian Gonzalez. Adrian Gonzalez, you know, Yonder Alonso, was kind of blocked in his original farm system because he was a Ranger, and the Rangers already had Mark Teixeira. He played some outfield, even in the big leagues, not very well. Can't run, unathletic. A lot of similarities to Yonder Alonso, and was thought of a hit-first, power-second guy. I'm not saying that Yonder Alonso is going to turn into Adrian Gonzalez in terms of that power, but I wouldn't be shocked if Yonder Alonso turned into that kind of player, turned into a star. I really wouldn't be shocked. I don't expect it to happen because there's nothing in his track record yet that indicates he's going to hit for big power, but it wouldn't stun me if he did it because he has that kind of hit ability. And I think he's the better fit in Petco Park at first base than Anthony Rizzo is. I guess the one thing that we ran into, JJ, at the winter meetings were some scouts who had pro coverage of the Padres organization and said they didn't see a star in the Padres farm system. I'm not banging on Matt Eddy here, but I would say Matt does our Padres, does them every year. I would have ranked Reimer Liriano number one in the Padres organization. He had Anthony Rizzo. There are good reasons to do Anthony Rizzo.
And the thing about it is that, and this is one of the things to remember with all our top tens.
Yeah.
The rankings, I understand. If you're looking at these, the rankings are important. You go, why is this guy? Oh, I had that guy one, that guy two.
Yeah.
Sometimes the difference between one and two or three and four
is
very minuscule, and sometimes it's massive. Sometimes it's like, well, that's clearly number one, and the next guy, if I was doing the top 100, that guy would be 50 spots below.
Right.
Other times you do it, and it's like, you know, on my personal top 50, I do the Royals, and Mike Montgomery, Bubba Starling. Personally, I have Mike Montgomery ahead of Bubba Starling. Well, but when I did a top 50, the next guy on my list was Bubba Starling.
Right.
They were that close together.
And we talked to Royals people at the winter meetings who were like, I could see Will Myers being number one there. So they have three legitimate number one candidates, and that's a good problem to have. I think the Padres have three legitimate number one candidates now with Alonso, Rizzo, Liriano. Liriano has the highest ceiling, but he's clearly the furthest away as well.
And Grandal's a really good number four at this point.
I think so, too. I think so, too. And the Padres, as an organization, are stockpiling some catching where they have a decent big league young catcher in Hundley. They have a guy who's a double-A catcher in Yasmani Grandal, who you expect to be a double-A, triple-A guy.
He'll be triple-A this year. I mean, he's been second half of the season double-A net last year. I would expect he'd be a triple-A this year.
Right, and then you're talking about a guy in Austin Hedges that they just gave $3 million to. So I don't think they aren't going to miss Brett Austin, their supplemental first-round pick catcher whom they didn't sign. They're set, I think, a catcher at the big league level. They have a good high-level prospect and a lower-level prospect they like a lot.
The thing that I think we've talked about that we both like about the Padres system is depth of the Padres system is very impressive. Now,
they have a lot of different options, and they have prospects at most positions who are interesting.
The criticism pre-trade, you know, when we heard criticism of the Padres, as you talked about, talking in the winter meetings to people, it's that, okay, they've got a lot of guys. There are a lot of guys who could be solid players.
Right.
Now, that can work for a team, but the thing about it is that, okay, do you have stars to – if those guys end up being just solid players, which, I mean, let's be honest, the majority of players who are prospects at any time aspire to be a
solid big leaguers, yeah.
But do you have stars to kind of – that worked very well for the Cardinals on their way to the World Series because – if you have Albert Pujols,
correct,
you know, and really, if you have Yadier Molina, who's an above-average catcher,
oh, no doubt,
you put those two,
and you have stars on the mound. You have Carpenter,
right? If you do that, you can have a lot of solid players, and everything works. If you had a question to me with the Padres, is okay. So how many impact guys do they have in the big leagues right now?
I think the biggest question for them, impact in the big leagues right now, Cam Maben.
That's potential. Yeah. He had a really solid year last year.
Yeah, I think he had a very good year. I mean, what did he steal, 40 bags?
Right.
I think Cameron Maven's an impact player. I'm not sure they have another potential one, to be honest with you.
That's
their issue.
That's where this trade, though, makes a lot of sense for them because you look forward. If Well, for one, they now have a trade chip.
Right.
Now,
one of those first basemen.
One of those first basemen. Now, one of those things is that we first base prospects,
yeah,
that trade chip's not as shiny as it may appear to be.
They learned that with Kyle Blanks. I mean, they had Kyle Blanks when he had some supposedly had some value, and they had Adrian Gonzalez at the time, and yeah, they didn't get anything for Kyle Blanks, and they're not going to get anything for Jesus Guzman, who was their second-best offensive player last year, or their best after Maben. So, yeah.
Well, look at it this way.
I mean, really, their best trade chip in the big leagues would be either Maben, who I don't think they want to trade, or Headley. You know, Chase Headley at third base.
But look at it this way. When we hear rumors of, you know, guys on the market, guys potentially being traded and all, right now, the best way I can put it is that right now, we talked about this a little bit on the XM show as well. If you said, okay, my team needs a shortstop, who right now, at this point, you know, basically a couple days before Christmas, who you're in desperate need of a shortstop, who are you going to go get?
Those teams that were like that went out and got Alex Gonzalez and Yunesky Betancourt.
Right, because
yeah,
there's no one out there. And if you want to make a trade for a shortstop, there's almost no one out there. But if you said right now, my team is in desperate need of a first baseman, you know, we've already seen our Pujols sign a massive, massive contract.
Right.
But right now,
Prince Fielder's going to sign one.
Prince Fielder's going to sign one. If you need to go big money, you can go Prince Fielder. But you know what? If that doesn't work for you, oh, we can't do that. You still have multiple options out
right
there to fill a spot at first base. And that's why you just don't get as much trade value for a first baseman is because of that.
Right. I think the other thing that has made the Padres system a pretty deep system, even though they have this overload, maybe you'd say, a first baseman, is they do have prospects elsewhere on the diamond. They've got guys up the middle from this year's draft. I think I like that would be the issue, is that they don't have guys at upper levels. But I like Corey Spangenberg. I like Jace Peterson as upside middle of the diamond guys with some speed, some athleticism, left-handed bats. They profile very well up the middle.
When we were working on the handbook, it jumped out. It's like, you know, there's very rarely are there a whole lot of second base prospects, but
right,
because of that, you look at it, and Spangenberg is—he's up there at the top, near the top of the list.
He is near the top of the list. I like their young pitching. I like the Mike Adams trade. Joe Weiland, Robbie Erlund. I think that we're probably bucking most prospect services or writers you see out there that we like Joe Weiland better than Robbie Erlund. I think Joe Weiland gets so little short on his fastball. JJ, you did a lot, our Carolina League list. Both those guys were in the Carolina League this year, and there's a split camp on those two
right
guys, isn't there?
Remember when we were talking about like, well, you could do this guy, you could do this guy. With those two, I think it's very close as well. Because
yeah,
if you like Erlund, he's left-handed.
Right.
He has a little bit, you know, I would say even a little bit better feel for pitching. That's nothing taken away from Joe Weiland. That's, you know, but just
that's
like,
tough. I don't know. I don't know if I even say that. I think you look for it more when you're looking at a small left-hander, so he gets more credit maybe for it. But I mean,
I just feel like
Weiland has better control.
No, I'm not saying control, but I'm saying feel for pitching. I'm talking about setting up hitters.
Right.
I'm talking about that.
Reading swings,
and
that
I'm
kind
talking
of thing
about having talked to, you know, pitching coaches who've had both of them and all that. And that's nothing against, you know,
Robbie Erlund has great feel.
Great Robbie Erlund. That's the thing that I've heard since they were in the Sally League was
right.
Robbie Erlund just has this. He has an understanding of pitching that's multiple years ahead of his age.
Sure.
Now, you could almost use that if you wanted to as a criticism of him, which is, okay, is his success going to wane a little bit as he gets – because really, even though he's been young for the leagues, he's been an old pitcher from the standpoint of
– right, it's like
a
guy who – right, exactly, like an old player stats for a hitter. He kind of
right
has those for a pitcher. And that's my real concern with him is that when he misses – He gives up a lot of home runs.
He gives up a lot of home runs because the reality of it is that his stuff is solid. But
that's my issue is that when he faces better hitters, they're going to make more consistent hard contact. And when lower-level hitters are making contact, they're making hard contact against Robbie Erlund.
Although I did look that up last year. The thing that was true also with him is that if you're one of the Bill James readers of the 80s and all, he always called it the Tommy John approach, which is the guys who didn't strike a whole lot of guys out, and they gave up homers. You know, they didn't walk guys. They gave up homers,
right,
but they didn't walk guys, and they didn't give up a whole lot of big innings. Robbie Erlund fit that pretty well.
He gave up a ton of solo home runs,
which if you're going to give up home runs, give up the solo jobs. I mean, he didn't give up big innings doing it. He would...
I guess the difference there is that he's doing it in A-ball. Tommy John was doing it in the big leagues.
Absolutely.
That's That's where my concern comes
in. But no, there's concern with that. You know, whereas with Weiland, I agree that his fastball is better than what people may think it is.
Yeah, I mean, we have reports that he was, you know, touching 94, 95 in the Texas League playoffs, and that was in September.
Right. It's still more likely, I would say, if you want to say, you know, I'd say his fastball is probably more 55 than anything more than that.
Maybe
60 if you say because he locates it so well. But he locates so well, he does not walk anyone.
Yeah, so I think he has a lot of the same strengths that Robbie Erlin has. A few more pluses, and the one thing he doesn't have is left-handedness.
I'll say this. They're both going to be in a great park for them to pitch, which Petco will be a great place for them.
Yeah, and I'm also admitting I really like – I've always liked Weiland. I've always – I liked him in high school. Report on him in high school, so I'm always going to be a little biased, I guess you'd say, on Joe Weiland.
So we've gotten the top two. Who do you have as the third best system in that division?
I've only got a couple other choices. I guess I would say it would be Colorado, just because I do like the prospects they got in their trade. But, you know, it's pretty hard to say that there's a good farm system considering that their lack of success in the first round and just, you know, the crashing and burning of their recent draft picks like Tyler Matzik and Peter Tago. But I still I think I like their system a little bit better than San Francisco's.
You have
at
the
Los
top
Angeles.
End, Pomeranz, Arenado. It drops off pretty quick.
It's two top 50 guys right there.
It drops off pretty quick after that.
Yeah, I suppose it does. suppose it does when you're looking at the rest of their farms. Although I like Chad Bettis. I like Chad Bettis quite a bit. So he's kind of always been a favorite of mine.
But I do think it's clear that I think there's a top two and then the jump, you know, the gap from two to three.
See, for me, Chad Bettis is a solid.
No, I'm not talking about Bettis. I'm talking about the team.
Organizations.
Organizations.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't say it's a cliff, but it's a pretty steep decline. You're going from, like, the Rockies or the Appalachians. You know, you're going to some very high peaks to the Rockies are basically steady. You know, this is an organization that is one of the more college-heavy organizations in the draft. Really, the strength of the Rockies organization the last 5-7 years has been they drafted Troy Tulowitzki when six other teams passed on him, and that's pretty special. And then Latin America. They've been very good in Latin America. And their drafts have not been as good. It's been a very conservative approach to the draft, and they're getting – a lot of times they've gotten one good player out of the draft, the Tulowitzki draft. They got one superstar. They didn't really get anything else out of that draft.
Although you'll take that.
If you'll take it, no doubt.
If you get Tulo and nothing else, you'll do that again.
No doubt. But when you're missing constantly on first-round picks, I'm not saying that – I'm not sure where the blame lies. If you're a Rockies fan, this is a story we'd like to try to report, but it's not an easy one to report. Why are they missing with domestic pitchers and not having a hard time developing Latin players? That, to me, points the finger at development, not scouting. And I think there's more evidence for that, JJ, when they've changed farm directors. They've changed minor league pitching coordinators. There's evidence there that they think the problem is development, not scouting. But when Christian Friedrich and Casey Weathers and Tyler Matzik and Peter Tago and Greg Reynolds, when all those guys falter, there's a pretty good pattern of problems with their top high draft pick pitchers. And I think to their credit, the Rockies are trying to make some changes to see if they can make that situation better. But I like their system, all right.
I was going to say that. It's funny, this does seem to happen to teams. Like, there are teams that go through this, you know, again, doing the Reds. There was a time where if you said the words Reds pitching prospect, you had to follow it with who's on the DL and he hopes to be back a year from now.
Yeah, back in the Ty Howington, Bobby Basham
Chris
era, those
Brewer,
kind of guys. That's,
you know,
right.
Like, yeah, there used to be the saying of, you know, well, what if the Reds had drafted Scott Kazmir instead of Chris Brewer because they were, you know, teammates and all. It's like, well, actually what would have happened is that Scott Kazmir would have never made it.
That's right. He would have gotten hurt in the minor leagues first, like Grueler did. But yeah, the Rockies have two pitchers in their, they have three pitchers in their top 10. Pomeranz, they didn't draft. Bettis, who's been their one high drafted pitcher in the last really 6 years, who's progressed well the way they wanted him to. And then they have Taylor Anderson, whom they just drafted this year. So Matzik, highest signing bonus in franchise history, I believe. And not in their top 10.
And I think,
no way he deserved to be in it. Friedrich, Tago, just a lot of other guys who've fallen off. And yet, meanwhile, a guy who's not in their top 10, but Edward Cabrera, led the minor leagues in strikeouts. Another example, their Latin program where, I mean, I don't like his profile. I don't like the fastball changeup guy with no breaking ball. But Edward Cabrera just keeps on doing it. He did it in the Northwest League, and then last year he did it at two A-ball levels, and he's
and one of those
intriguing.
A-ball levels is not an easy place to pitch.
Right, yeah, in the California League, absolutely. I would say Giants are next, JJ, even though they're, it's not your older brother's Giants farm system, because it's not a pitching heavy farm system.
But that's fine, because they're good on the pitching. They need to be a little position player heavy right now.
Absolutely. I do think it's a nod to organization like the Giants, I give their prospect pitchers more rope than I give other organizations.
Because they have a track record of turning guys into, struggle for a while, they figure it out.
I don't think Heath Hembree ranking third is a great sign. That it's a guy with a very thin track record of success. But at the same time, I expect the Giants to get a lot out of Heath Hembree. A raw power arm, a guy who's hit 98 consistently. The Ninja's going to, Dick Tidrow will get every ounce. He will squeeze every ounce out of that guy. And so will Dave Rigetti at the big league level. I mean,
They have a track record of their pitchers get better.
I fully expect Hembree to contribute in the big league bullpen in San Francisco in 2012. And he might be in some high leverage situations, depending on the health of the other big league pitchers.
Now, I mean, Gary Brown's number one.
Yeah.
And with Brown, he's not, it's interesting. They had moved some guys pretty quickly. Brandon Belt, the year before, moved very quickly.
Right.
Gary Brown, they moved on a much slower track. They basically left him in the Cal League all year last year. And the interesting thing about that is because of that, I would say, he's what, probably a year and a half away still? Probably a year?
I think probably a year, yeah. I think
Which they have a guy. They went out and got Melky Cabrera.
I think he's going to be accelerated in 2012 myself. I think he'll start at AA, and if he has the kind of success he did in A-ball, if he keeps hitting like that, I think he's going to be moved fairly quickly. But yeah, like you said, Melky Cabrera does buy them some time, certainly.
But they do have an option where it's like there's no need to rush him.
Right.
But I do think he... They're pointing towards him being a key part of them going forward, because he can be that table setter type guy, ideally.
And I think the other interesting guy in their farm system is Tommy Joseph, just because obviously you have Posey, and Posey's the key to all of this for them. How he comes back from the ankle injury, does he have to move positions? Last year Pablo Sandoval was a good defensive third baseman according to the metrics and according to people who watched him. I'm not saying he was a gold glover. I don't believe the metrics saying he was like the guy who saved the most runs at third base. I think that's
but
a little. But he clearly is acceptable
put it this way.
There.
Basically, with Pablo, you could kind of, okay, does he look like one Pablo Sandoval or two Pablo
that's
Sandovals?
Right.
And if he's one Pablo Sandoval, he can be pretty decent defensively.
Absolutely. But when you have Belt at first, you assume for the long term. You have Sandoval at third base, you assume for the long term. Those are the most likely spots for Buster Posey to have moved if he can't catch. I suppose he'd go to an outfield corner.
I was gonna say, I do think he is, if you're saying which catcher could make the move to the outfield.
Right.
He's one of those who could, because
I just don't think we know, because it's an ankle injury.
Now,
we
do not know if the pre-injury, I would say he would have had no problem. We're talking about a really athletic catcher. Was
right.
A shortstop, was
guy
a
played
pitcher.
Played all nine positions in his last regular season
right.
college game.
I mean, he came to Florida State as a pitcher shortstop. I mean, this
right.
was not someone who, that guy's definitely a catcher. They saw something and thought he could be a really great catcher, which they saw something right.
They were right.
But what his calling card was athleticism, not, this guy's so slow, so...
The phrase I got from a scouting director last year was it's baseball athleticism. It's not like – it's not Mike Stanton overwhelming athleticism, but it's baseball athleticism. He's sports specific. He basically has great baseball instincts and enough athleticism to do everything that he needs to do on a baseball
diamond. I'll put it this way.
I like that phrase.
I'll put it this way. As long as the ankle comes back somewhat okay. If Yonder Alonso can play left field in the big leagues...
Good way to put it.
I mean, which we were just talking about Yonder Alonso. Nothing against Yonder Alonso. If Yonder Alonso can play it, Buster Posey can play it.
Absolutely. No, I agree. But I think Tommy Joseph is a very nice hedge on the health of Buster Posey long term. I think the Minnesota Twins wish they had a Tommy Joseph
because they don't have that hedge.
They don't. Chris Herrmann is not as good of a hedge. And I like Chris Herrmann.
They had a hedge.
Let's
be clear. They had a hedge.
Wilson,
they let him go.
Tommy Joseph is an American Wilson Ramos. I think that's actually a pretty good comp. He doesn't control the strike zone. He's got power. He's got arm strength. You worry about the body and his long-term flexibility staying behind the plate. But I like Tommy Joseph. I think he's a pretty important prospect. And then they have other guys in their system who are pretty interesting. I mean, they have three catchers in their top 10 with Joseph, Susak, and Hector Sanchez. There's some lottery tickets in their farm system in 11 to 20. The Giants are actually probably pushing the Rockies for me. If the Rockies hadn't made that trade, the Ubaldo trade, I probably would have taken the Giants farm system over the Rockies.
And I think we agree. And, we like to use a joke around here, harkening back to 80s Saturday Night Live, which we both referenced to way too much.
Yeah.
But Sulu, you let yourself go.
That's right.
I mean, with the
I still
Dodgers,
think that's early 90s.
I
could
guess
be wrong.
It is. Yeah,
it's late 80s. Late 80s. There's a lot of big hair on the cast at that time.
But with the Dodgers, what was once kind of one of the gold standards.
I would say like 2003, 4, 5 Dodgers farm system, that was the gold standard. When they had that Jacksonville team where we did a top 10 just on the Jacksonville Suns and we were too low on Matt Kemp. But, I mean, that was a farm system. That was one
it's
of that,
not that,
that
farm
was,
system anymore.
To me, the Dodgers farm system at that time was the last farm system that was just like elite before 2010 Royals. I would say the Dodgers were the best one prior to last year's Royals farm system. But that's not the Dodgers right now. The ravages of the McCourt ownership have taken their toll the most on where the Dodgers have been.
Well,
they stick
and
the slot 100%.
Yeah, explain this. They don't spend money internationally.
Even Zach Lee getting that big bonus last year, but it was a below slot for the 2010 draft. It's spread out over five years.
So you did not have to cut a big check, which was good because
it would
have McCourt, Frank McCourt did not have the check to cut.
He would have had to sell a house to pay Zach Lee.
And
he wasn't going to sell one of those seven houses or whatever
but,
it was.
But you look at it, and I mean, again, you this is one of those cases where you see what's happened.
Yeah.
It's not something where you go, oh, man, they've just drafted terribly and look where they got. Where they've gotten to is that
although they did have a couple drafts.
They've had some
rough
bad drafts. No, I'm not saying they haven't, but there is the spending a lot of money and drafting poorly approach.
Right.
Like we just talked about Tyler Matzik.
Right.
If Tyler Matzik doesn't turn it back around.
Again, I wouldn't say they drafted poorly there, but yes, where you spend a lot of money and it doesn't work out. That's the Rockies' issue. That is not the Dodgers' issue.
The Dodgers' issue is if you don't spend money, and especially they've had a very good international program.
Historically.
I mean, you can Pedro Martinez, Ramon
yes,
Martinez. I mean, you
exactly.
could, 72 shortstops that I could name.
Right.
You know,
Henry Rodriguez.
But you could, they've always had that. What they are reduced to now is basically they shop, if there are some teams that shop at, Saks Fifth Avenue.
Right.
And there are a lot of teams that shop at the Walmart, they're at the Dollar General.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, they're basically going, what are the returns? What are the, the overstocks that we can. They're looking for, okay, here's the 19-year-old that everyone's overlooked because
right.
they're looking at 16-year-olds.
My favorite prospect in the Dodgers organization, not because of his upside, but my favorite story is Angel Sanchez, their right-hander who was at Great Lakes this year, who was signed out of a Dominican college. The Dominican college, they talk about a demographic that you just don't see in the handbook too often. We had a Puerto Rican junior college player drafted this year, I believe by the Royals, right? Left-hander?
Yeah.
It's like their sixth or seventh round pick.
Yeah.
That was a first. I didn't remember a Puerto Rican junior college player, from a junior college in Puerto Rico. But this is a Dominican college player who signed for $7,500 and had a very nice year.
Which is probably among the higher amounts that the Dodgers.
Right, because I think it's more than Alfredo Silverio, who's their top position player prospect. I thought that he signed for $5,000 with the Dodgers, and Ruby De La Rosa was a $15,000 bonus.
That's what I'm saying. They have good scouts down there.
Oh, yeah. They've done a great job.
They've done a great job because
And domestically, too. I mean, D. Gordon. Nobody else was on D. Gordon. They got him in the fifth round out of a NCCAA school, which is a National Christian College Athletic Association. I think he went to that school for a year, then to a junior college
and didn't play it here. Yeah.
Right.
And then you had Jerry Sands and Alan Webster, who I think, Lon Joyce was the scout for both of them, and I think combined, where they're last year, they were two of their top 10 prospects, and combined, I think it was $25,000.
Something like that. And Webster ranks second. But thank goodness for Jim Schoenert, who did the Dodgers top 30, that Nady Eovaldi was still available, still eligible, that Josh Lindblom was still eligible.
It's a lot of pitchers. That's what it is. There's, the position player-wise, there's not much left in the system, but there are some interesting pitchers still.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that he made it. I think we actually considered ranking Justin Sellers in their top 30. No, he did not make it. But, I mean, like, you can tell their farm system is thin. When they drafted Jake Lumberman out of Duke, it was a nice find in the fifth round, had a great debut. And last year, they're so thin on farm on middle infielders, they moved him all the way to double A. And he was not ready for that. And yeah, he's a nice little role player, extra guy at the big league level eventually. But guys like Ivan De Jesus have dropped off. But, like, trading for call and getting Alex Castellanos. Alex Castellanos would have been a back of the top 30 guy, maybe at best, in the Cardinal system. He's number 18, 19 for the Dodgers. He's a nice little sleeper, but yeah, position player wise, the Dodgers are really they're really hurting, and the fact that they don't spend in Latin America or the draft, JJ, just kind of kills them.
Speaking of transitioning here, now we've done the West, but speaking of a team that does spend, especially internationally,
yes, good
so
transition.
Yu Darvish, you know, is not signed, but we do know who won the post. I mean,
right.
The Rangers won the bid.
By some reports, by a slim margin over the Blue Jays. By
but
other
it appears
reports,
like more reports are coming
large,
out. By a
large
margin.
Like $30 million.
Which, now, I ask you, so what, I mean, do you think, you assume it's going to take another 50 or so to probably sign Darvish?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that they're going to sign him for $25 million, which would be, you know, basically what, you know, what they didn't sign C.J. Wilson for. I mean, you're talking about giving this guy probably $70 million, which is what C.J. Wilson actually got. On top of the $51 million you already paid him, you're looking at a $120 million investment for Yu Darvish.
Now, there's some risk there because we've seen this.
There's a lot of risk there.
We've seen this. I mean, there are the track record of Japanese pitchers, there have not been many who've come along and had consistent success.
Yes, yeah, sustained success.
Sustained success, no.
I mean, that's the big issue is that, to me, the biggest question about any pitcher from any foreign league, Cuba, Japan, whatever, is the grind. It's eaten up a lot of pitchers. Even El Duque, who's the best foreign pitcher, Japan, Cuba, wherever, Korea, the best guy out of all those guys is El Duque for me. He had the longest run of sustained big league success. And even he, I don't think he ever pitched 200 innings in a big league season.
The guy who's been able to pitch.
Ace.
The guy who's been able to didn't have the peak of, but the guy.
I'm saying El Duque over Levon.
No, I know. I'm saying,
okay.
But the guy who has shown that he can handle the grind, he's not great. But Levon Hernandez, like, soaks up innings as if
apparently
like
that's the way to handle the grind is to be enormous and to throw 83.
Yeah,
that's it. I'm still taking El Duque as
no,
the
I'm
best
not, and I'm not even arguing that, but I'm saying like, but when you talk about the
but
grind,
yeah, Levon is that's a great example.
Levon eats innings like he eats hamburgers.
I bet you he's pitched the most innings in the last 20 years of any major leaguer who's come from Cuba's league or Korea or NPB, Nippon Professional Baseball.
But
so that's my issue still with Darvish. That's my concern.
So that's the rolling the dice. At the same time, if you look at the stuff, if you look at the age, if you look at the frame, you add it all up, he is the best. I would argue he's the best available pitcher on the market this year as far as that. Now, from a pure scouting standpoint, now again, I agree with you. There are risks there because we have to see. It's easier. I've heard multiple ways to describe, but one of the ways I've heard describe pitching in Japan is it's somewhat still go back to pitching in the U.S. back in the 30s and
16 team,
you know,
major leagues.
Right. And back in the time where the idea was, okay, I got to bear down on this guy.
Right.
Okay,
right.
This guy, I can just rear back and throw. Okay, this guy, no, I got to really bear down. I got to give him my best stuff because
right.
This guy can hurt me. Not everyone in the lineup can hurt you. They're not. That's one of the things I've heard. Well,
yeah, I think that's a fair characterization of it.
But that being said, if you compare stuff, if you compare age, you know, if you're going to roll the dice, they're rolling the dice with a guy who, at the end of this contract, whatever it is, won't be that old.
Right, but he's an old 25.
Right.
I mean, I'm sorry. He's an old 25. All these Japanese pitchers have more mileage on them at 25.
They do.
Than American guys do, with rare exceptions, because they're not handled. They're handled a completely different way, and especially as amateurs. For example, Tsuyoshi Wada, the left-hander who signed with the Orioles, 476 strikeouts in a college season. I mean, how many pitches did Tsuyoshi Wada throw? Now, he's held up. He came to the United States as a pure free agent, did not have to go through the posting system. I think he's 31 years old. I wrote about Tsuyoshi Wada pitching against Team USA college national team, and I wrote about him throwing 183 pitches in a game against Team USA and then pitching on 3 days rest. And he made it through. I'm just saying that Yu Darvish, he's 25. I guess I'll be 26 for next season. I don't think he can. I don't think that's really that big of a factor, to be completely honest with you. He's going. I think it will help him make the transition. But in terms of projecting him long term, I don't think you can treat him like a normal 25-year-old. Just like for reasons you said, he's had a high pitch count. He's been worked harder. He's been worked once a week. His usage is going to change completely, and I think it's very difficult to predict how he will adjust.
No,
but I think in the short term, he's going to be very, very good. I think he'll be better than Daisuke or Hiroki Kuroda or even Jose Contreras to make a cross comp to a Cuban.
I'll throw it out there. One of the things that at least I've seen floated out there is if you're the Rangers, do you consider a six-man rotation?
I did see that floated. I think it will help him that the Rangers, under Nolan Ryan, are a more open-minded organization
toward
throwing programs, training programs. I think the Rangers will probably let him train the way Yu Darvish wants to train, which was a significant source of friction between the Red Sox and Daisuke Matsuzaka.
And the other thing with that is that the Rangers, they, as much as you can know what you're getting with the Japanese pitcher, they've been on Yu Darvish for a while.
There's a lot of information there. I think it's likely that the Red Sox scouted Daisuke Matsuzaka just as heavily.
And
in terms of being there and also just the amount of video that's available of these players, I think we know a lot more about Japanese pitchers than we knew about Cuban pitchers when they come over, for example. But Yu Darvish, he's a better prospect at the same age and the same stage of coming over to the United States than Daisuke Matsuzaka was. I don't think there's a question about that. Is he better than, say, an Aroldis Chapman was or a Jose Contreras or even a Levon Hernandez?
I put Levon at a different level than, say, like a Aroldis Chapman. because he was
21 years old.
But the thing with Chapman, though, is that Chapman, you are essentially, like with a Chapman, you are signing a prospect.
Right. He was a prospect. He was not a polished product.
He was not someone who you say.
Compared to Levon.
Right. Levon Hernandez and with Yu Darvish, you are signing a guy not as a prospect. You're signing a guy who basically, let's be honest, with the money they're giving him, he's the number one in the Rangers. I mean, he's their ace.
Right. Right. Levon Hernandez was like, I think he spent half of his first year in the United States in AA before he came to the
big
leagues.
Which was almost like an acclimation thing as much as.
It was. I mean, he was 21 years old. But I mean, like, he wasn't the stud for Cuba in 1996. He was one of many.
Right.
And it's amazing now that Cuba really has no pitchers like that. But Japan still does. But Darvish stood out even when all the pitching numbers were great in Japan because offense was so far down there. And we had a nice story on that from our Tim Edenoff, one of our interns here at Baseball America, right now our only intern. But Tim did a great job on this story explaining how offense was so far down in Japan this year because of lighting standards and a different ball they used. But Darvish's numbers still stood out, and he was clearly the best pitcher before. He was the best pitcher and the guy who's the most Western pitcher. I think that helps as well. He's Western in terms of his size, in terms of his parents met in the United States. He's multicultural. I think he's the most Western guy.
And in terms, I mean, let's be honest.
And his delivery.
His delivery,
right?
And his stuff. I mean, that.
I think those things will help.
He does not pitch backwards as much as many Japanese pitchers do.
I think that change in the ball and in the offensive nature in Japan this year, that was perfect timing because the scouts that Tim talked to said that he pitched more off the fastball in 2011 than he had in previous years, in part because he knew he could miss with a fastball and get away with it because of the ball.
And I just think that helps him. Like, if you want to, like, there are many things you can talk about with why Matsuzaka has not had sustained success like he was expected to.
Right.
But one of the ones you have to come back to is that he has been a nibbler.
Absolutely.
In the U.S. It does not appear that he's ever really trusted his stuff as much as he should.
Right. And we'll see. But that's the scouts that we've talked to, whether it's, us or Tim or whomever, because we had Darvish number one in our WBC top 10 a couple years ago. I guess it was a top 20. But none of those guys expect him to nibble or pitch as backwards as Matsuzaka did, to pitch so much off your off-speed stuff. I do kind of worry from time to time about the guy with the six or seven pitches, but there has been, thankfully, no talk of the gyro ball with Yu Darvish. He doesn't rely on trickeration, and Matsuzaka shouldn't have, and he did to his detriment, and I don't think Yu Darvish will. So to me, it makes a lot of sense. I expect him to have a lot of success in the short term. I still think the adjustment to the United States is going to be a big deal to see whether he can hold up over the long term. But I like Texas's chances of, you know, they got C.J. Wilson converted from reliever to starter, and he became a workhorse instantly. Alexi Ogando basically went from Dominican Summer League and winter ball to big league starter instantly. And yes, he faded as the season went on, but he still had quality stuff to help them in the postseason out of the bullpen. So they have options.
And they have, and again, they also they have Neftali Feliz, who,
and I expect that transition to work well as well. I don't know that he'll be as dominant as a starter as he was at times in the bullpen.
The only thing I worry about with Feliz, there's two things. I mean, he's not had to rely that much on secondary stuff,
right,
out of the bullpen. But more than that, as a closer, you can be, you know, location doesn't matter as much, and that's been a problem for him at times. At the same time, he does have the stuff that he doesn't have to be precise. He just needs to be close.
He needs to throw strikes. He can get away without throwing tons of quality strikes.
Really? I know one of them's right-handed, one of them's left-handed, but, you know, the Reds are also talking about a role as Chapman's going to be a starter this year.
Yeah, it's pretty similar.
I think they're very similar from the standpoint of you're talking about two guys with dominating fastballs who secondary stuff comes and goes.
They're both pitching. I mean, Chapman's going to pitch with an 8 fastball as a starter. I mean, he's going to pitch at 94 to 97 and higher as a starter.
Mm-hmm. And with the ability to reach back and, you know, for a pitch, hey, I can give you 99.
Yeah, or 100. Or 100, you know, yeah. Maybe he, even as a starter, maybe he can still reach back and give you that 103, 104. That was once doubted. But, yeah, I mean, Neftali Feliz, I think he's going to pitch with an 8 fastball in terms of velocity. The control grades for both those guys really just have to be 5s. You know, if they can just have average control. But that's it. And I think that Neftali Feliz probably pitched with like 4 control in the out of the bullpen.
And then the question becomes,
like,
okay.
Yeah, he can't do that.
That was a 4 out of the bullpen needing, okay, for one inning. Does that get better or does that get worse? You can argue both ways. Do you stop overthrowing a little bit, which helps it get better? Or do you, by the 4th inning, your mechanics get a little bit more out of whack, you're a little more fatigued, and it gets worse.
I don't think he has, like, a terrible delivery. I don't think he has – I think he has the physique, the build to be a durable guy, and I think that it helps that C.J. Wilson – they've already done that with C.J. Wilson. And let's face it, they took a Japanese – a pitcher from Japan on that 140-game workload in Colby Lewis, and he's been durable in the major league. So there are a lot of indicators that show you that Texas probably is not just the
it's
team that spent
place.
The most on Yu Darvish, but is a place where Yu Darvish should have success, is most likely to have success, and where that is most likely to take a guy like Neftali Feliz and make him a successful starter. There are positive indicators there. I think they understand pitching better than most organizations.
And if they can pull that off,
that's a devastating tandem.
Because the thing about it is that what you just hit on, they have the thing that they have going for them is that, yes, they're going to spend – if they sign Yu Darvish, they're going to spend a ton of money on him.
Yeah.
But all their eggs are not in that basket.
I agree.
If he falters this year, that doesn't mean, well, okay, then the plans have all fallen apart.
This is a pretty intriguing rotation of a Darvish, Feliz, Holland, Harrison, Lewis. Those
and
pieces
that, by the
fit.
Way,
that's a lot of power.
And by the way, as you just
right,
mentioned,
left.
Ogando is the 6th option.
Ogando's the swing guy. I think Ogando goes to the bullpen. He could be your closer. He could just swap, really, with Feliz, theoretically. But I know they have Joe Nathan also in that mix, but that's power arms, right, left. Then you have a durable touch feel command right-hander and Colby Lewis in the middle. You have postseason experience. There's a lot of upside to that. So Albert Pujols
and,
or
by
not.
The way, and they also have, they still, if they find they have a hole in midseason and need to do something,
they
have
the
one
system.
Of the best farm systems in baseball to fix it.
We'll be talking about that in the new year as we ring in the new year with American League podcast, JJ, and like I said, some amateur podcasts as well. But, yeah, I think the Rangers are the most logical landing spot for Darvish. I think they have a very good chance of both Feliz and Darvish having at least short-term success and back-to-back American League pennants. Getting Darvish, having those kind of power arms, that kind of potential in the rotation, and the best farm system in the American League for sure, if not the entire major leagues, a pretty good time to be a Rangers fan.
By the way, before we wrap up, two interesting things with this. One, the Blue Jays apparently were number 2 in the bidding for Darvish. May have been many, many, many millions behind.
Right.
But Which, if you're the Blue Jays, that's not all bad. Again, you get a little your name out again that you were really trying to do things.
Sure, absolutely.
Never a bad thing. The interesting thing, though, is that we've gone through, we are, at this point, I would say, I know we aren't time-wise, but chronologically, but as far as moves, we're about at least three-fourths of the way through the offseason.
Feels like it, yeah.
There's not...
Most of the big shoes
most
have
of the
dropped.
Big stuff, you know, has happened now. We yep. still have Prince Fielder hanging out there, but most everything else...
Yeah, who's the best pitcher left on the market? Like Ryan Madsen, because he's a really good relief pitcher? I mean, like...
Yeah.
And now that John Danks has been locked up to a probably too rich contract, but... There's not a whole lot of even great trade candidates. I guess Gio Gonzalez is like the big trade name available.
So most of the moves have been made. The interesting thing about this is we've had an offseason. The Yankees have been...
And they may have been third in the Yu Darvish thing. I guess their bid was reported around $20 million. So they were clearly interested. But that bid, I mean, like, they... I wonder how high they might have gone if they had had even just one good year out of Kiyagawa, who's finally out of their system. But, I mean, because Japan... They're 1-for-3. Hideki Matsui was worth it. Hideki Arabu, not worth it. And Kiyagawa, one of the worst contracts of all time. $46 million, basically, so, between the post and the contract for Scranton's all-time wins leader. I guess that's because of the money involved, that's a worse contract than even Andrew Brackman.
But you look at it and you go, okay, is that like that there is a limit even for them? Or, you know, because it is interesting. We've had an offseason where the Red Sox and the Yankees normally are the teams that, you know, at some point make one of those moves where everyone, you know,
right.
goes, oh, look, you know.
The
you
splash know, move, yeah.
The splash move. And now we're going through an offseason, obviously both a little bit, you know, like in the Red Sox case, they were burned by doing that last
yeah,
year.
Yeah, no
so
doubt.
Maybe that's why. Or. Maybe it's the you know offseason also. They
I know other people. Somebody else I saw blogged about this. But one what we could have done, maybe if we're here next week, maybe we'll throw in an amnesty podcast. We have had the baseball amnesty. If a baseball had the NBA contract amnesty, who would you amnesty? The Red Sox would be a very difficult decision between Carl Crawford and John Lackey, I have to imagine. Whom would you amnesty?
To me, I'm especially with the injury now, I'm probably saying, okay, John Lackey.
See, I still think I would say Carl Crawford. I think it's easier for a pitcher to come back from Tommy John than for Carl Crawford with that
yeah,
swing
in some ways you could argue,
and that contract.
You could argue with Lackey. The good news you can say is that, well, at least, being hurt is actually a good thing here.
Yeah, and I would amnesty Carl Crawford and take that contract and say, Jacoby Ellsbury, please. Here's the money that we gave to Carl Crawford that we should be paying you. That would be a fun podcast. We don't have time to delve into all that, but... Teams like the Yankees and the Red Sox and the Angels even have so many bad contracts. I guess the Angels is just Vernon Wells, and that's it. You really just end the conversation there.
No, I was
but the
say,
Yankees, have so many bad contracts.
But
that could be a fun
which,
podcast.
Like Vernon Wells, so where does he fit in the 2012?
Understand, Peter Gammons addressed it. But, no, I mean, I don't think Peter just mentioned Vernon Wells' name in passing in his Pujols signing contract column and – He just basically said Vernon Wells has to produce. Well, like, yeah, for whom? I mean, I don't see why you don't just eat that contract and just cut him. I mean, because Mike Trout's better, Peter Borges is better, Torrey Hunter's better. Two of those guys are cheap.
And by the way, and you
Mike
also
Trout
have,
needs to play.
You right now at least. Oh, okay. Well, maybe we can move him DH. Oh wait, but we've got Trumbo
and Abreu and Trumbo
Morales and Abreu.
That's it. Those guys need to play. Yeah, you can't play Vernon Wells at DH. Maybe Vernon Wells is the kind of poison pill you try to give someone else so you don't have to get a prospect back. But you can have Mark Trumbo, but you're going to have to take Vernon Wells too. I don't think anybody's
Mark
taking
Mark Trumbo to get Vernon Wells. I'm not that is something I'm not.
There are other first basemen you can get, as we talked about earlier in the podcast.
I mean, again,
there are not that many general managers left who will take Vernon Wells, including Tony Regans, who made that deal.
I mean, maybe there is, but it's something where you're fielding so much of that contract that.
I mean, he used to be thought of as a guy that the Rangers used to want to target because he's from that area, but that's not happening. Rangers have clearly shown they're a little bit smarter than that.
I was going to say.
I don't want to end the podcast on Vernon Wells' note, a contract amnesty, but he's the most obvious contract amnesty, I think, in the game.
Yeah.
Him or Alex Rios, both contracts signed by J.P. Ricciardi, so that'd be fun to have J.P.
And both
as a
somehow
guest.
The Blue Jays managed to get rid of.
Yes, much to Alex Anthopoulos' credit. Speaking of the Blue Jays, they are going to be in the next podcast we do on the top 10. That's an American League East podcast. So we still have three issues of Top Tens to Go. I think some of our digital edition subscribers have already received their American League East issue. By the way, the digital edition is now available. The new digital edition brings you the magazine on the go. You're no longer waiting by the mailbox for the latest issue of Baseball America to arrive. Every 2 weeks, you'll be notified by email that a new digital edition is available. Visit baseballamerica.com/subscribe and get in for as low as $1.76 an issue. That's the Baseball America digital edition. So, JJ, you'll be checking it out over the holidays?
Yes.
When you're traveling?
You know, with the Disney World experience and all that.
So have a holly jolly Christmas and a merry new year. If I don't talk to you before the new year, I may be back next week at a Contract Amnesty podcast. I'm mulling that over in my head of me and Ben Badler doing a Contract Amnesty podcast. That could be fun. For JJ Cooper, I am John Manuel. Thanks for downloading the Baseball America podcast. So long, everybody.